You are listening to Kilometre Zero by The Cycling Podcast, powered by Zwift, the fitness app where fun is fast.
Throughout the Grandest Tour, as we have called our coverage of the Giro d'Italia, the Classics and the Vuelta a España, we have produced 9 episodes of Kilometre Zero thanks to the support of Zwift. For this, the 10th and final episode, we are telling the story of a remarkable Giro, with a focus on Stage 18, which went over the mythical Stelvio climb. We'll look back in the company of the winner, Theo Gegenhardt, and the runner-up, Jai Hindley. We will also hear from Hindley's Sunweb sports director, Luke Roberts, with the key moments from the race selected by some of us at the Cycling Podcast and by Eurosport commentator Rob Hatch. Let's hear first from the winner, Theo Gegenhardt.
Yeah, it's quite strange really, isn't it? It's pretty bizarre. I guess I'll kind of have to semi get used to it, but I'm also quite enjoying it being surreal and unbelievable in some ways, because it's something quite nice in that, I would say.
Jai Hindley, Team Sunweb.
Oh, yeah, I mean, at the moment it hadn't really kicked in, you know, what had happened, but I think now, like, yeah, looking back and doing all the media stuff as well, it's definitely like put it into reality, you know, what happened. And I mean, for me, it's still hard to wrap my head around, but yeah, it's been pretty crazy.
Luke Roberts, sports director, Team Sunweb.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great result in the end. Didn't go there with an expectation of landing on the podium, and you know, hope to get the best result we could, and just the teamwork and the way we've ridden throughout the race, and put us in with that opportunity to almost take the victory overall. So.
I rolled down the ramp with almost no adrenaline. I'd been, you know, kind of told a few times just to really take it easy and stay safe. And that kind of was hammered home even more when we found out how many riders had crashed in the recon. And then obviously I was in the second to last wave when the wind direction had changed a little bit. But we'd watched Rowan do half his time trial on the base bar, which, you know, is unimaginable, I would say, and obviously we'd seen a lot of riders crash as well, so it was a bit of a strange start for me, to be honest, because the conditions had changed, so those last two waves were considerably slower. I took it very safe and steady, and you know, didn't go full gas in just thinking of all the race to come really, and all the job I had to do. And that was my clearly defined role. So that was, you know, I was actually happy when I crossed the line. It was job done. I'd stayed safe, all things considered. And, you know, the 2 minutes that I lost at that day to Pipo Ganna seemed incredibly insignificant, which was you know, I was happy. G had done a great ride. You know, we were super happy that day. Pipo had been incredible, and G had put time into everyone. So it was smiles all around.
Lionel Burney. A bouncing water bottle completely altered the course of the Giro d'Italia. We're into slightly speculative territory here, of course, but what we can say is that Geraint Thomas's form was good and improving when he arrived in Sicily for the start of the Giro. He had looked shaky when he first returned to racing in August, but second at Tirreno Adriatico and fourth in the World Time Trial Championships confirmed he was ready to lead Ineos Grenadiers. Now, Thomas's career has been punctuated by stunningly bad luck, so much so it makes me wonder whether he spends the off-season breaking mirrors, walking under ladders and spilling salt. During the neutral zone at the start of Stage 3 from Enna to Etna, there was a downhill section through town over large paving stones, which caused bottles to go flying. One of those bottles went under Thomas's rear wheel, causing his bike to swerve. He went down hard and hit the kerb. It was a freak accident, a horrible crash to see, and it was impossible for him to avoid. Thomas battled on and finished the stage, but he was dropped before the climb to Etna, and it was clear his GC hopes were over even before an X-ray confirmed he'd fractured his pelvis. It was the key moment of the race because it forced Ineos Grenadiers to reset and reassess their entire Giro. and to put it simply, it presented an opportunity for Theo Gegenhardt that just wouldn't have been there otherwise, because he'd have had a crucial team role to play instead of being allowed to watch, wait, ride like a GC contender without any of the pressure or the spotlight before picking his moments perfectly.
Yeah, I was right next to Geraint when he crashed. I heard the noise and seen obviously my teammate, I didn't know who it was, go down really hard. And my first real scare was there was about a meter after Geraint crashed, the building came out 2 meters into the road, if that makes sense. So the road narrowed, and I thought he'd just gone straight into the building, which would have been even worse than his crash was. Obviously, after the stage, I saw what had actually happened on the videos. But, I mean, it was just unbelievably unlucky. It was 300-400 metres into the neutral, and, you know, a bottle flew across the road. We were all together, the entire team. I think, you know, Swifty and Salva were 20 metres in front of us, but Rowan and I were right next to G, and we just stopped immediately and kind of stood there for what felt like a very, very long time, watching G and watching the staff trying to help him. And it was pretty clear from the first moments really that it was a bad crash, because he was on the floor for a long time. And yeah, it was something you never really expect to happen, something I've never seen happen before. A very, very strange start to what was a very difficult stage, really, both legs and you know, for everyone in the team. I wouldn't say that the Giro changed the moment he crashed, actually, because we didn't speak about it first and foremost. You know, the bunch obviously waited at kilometer zero. G and all of us caught up. He then got some medical treatment for probably 5 or 6 minutes, and then we started the race. It was a downhill start. There was a rider from one team that crashed within 2 or 3 kilometres into a barrier on a downhill corner after attacking. This is one thing I can remember. But the main thing was we just approached the stage exactly the same. We didn't change our plan. We didn't even speak about it. We just, you know, tried to act as if nothing had happened, and G did the same. There was these kind of series of 2-3K climbs coming into Etna, and the pace had really, really been on for probably over an hour and a half, 2 hours. I think a few of the guys, I remember, were saying after the stage that I remember Rowan saying he'd set an hour or a 2 hour maximum power for quite a long time. It was over a year or two PB. So it was a really intense stage. There was a few really dangerous moments, downhill cobbles again. And those Sicilian towns, it happened for 4 days. There was bottles flying everywhere. There was downhill wet cobbles. And it wasn't just in G's crash that we saw that kind of thing happening. And then on the last kicker before we kind of descended down to the base of Etna, G came on the radio and just kind of said, guys, I can't put any power with one of my legs, and it's not going to happen. And Swifty just straight away said, Theo, stay in the front and ride your own race. I'll stay with Geraint. So, Salva stayed with me, Puccio. He put me in really good position for the bottom of the climb, and then the rest of the lads, Castro was with me as well for the whole climb, and the rest of the lads kind of obviously stayed with Geraint and stayed with him to the finish. And yeah, it was probably the worst performance of my Giro, to be honest, that climb on Etna. I felt super, super good for about 40, 45 minutes, but I think I was so focused on trying to do something amongst all the melee and making the most of that opportunity that, in hindsight, I think I just didn't fuel enough at all in that last 2 or 3 hours. Didn't realise how hard it was, in part because I was going pretty well, and just kind of took it all in my stride. And just that last 3K when it ramped up again, I just completely lost my legs, but is what it is.
Lizzie Banks, My key moment of the race is the departure of both Jumbo-Visma and Mitchelton Scott at the beginning of stage 10, the day after the rest day. I think it's pretty impossible to imagine what the race would have been like with these two teams from then on, because you've got two big teams who are able, and in the case of Jumbo-Visma, expected to control the race. And it was also sad not to be able to see what Steven Kruijswijk could do. He came so close to winning in 2016 before he crashed into a pile of snow at the top of a mountain. And who knows what the outcome would have been. And I think it would have been a very different race. And really, you know, these two teams having to leave the race because of coronavirus, it kind of epitomises the whole of what 2020 has thrown at us and everything that comes so unexpectedly. But without doubt, it changed the race hugely.
Rob Hatch, TV commentator for Eurosport and GCN. Well, I'm going to go back to Piancavallo at the end of the second week. It was a mountain stage, one that Pantani and Landa had won on previously down the years. Here, Almeida lost contact with the front of the race for the first time. He fought well to keep the pink jersey, but behind, Sunweb showed that out of the teams riding the GC at the time, they had by far and away the strongest mountain train. Kelderman went from being the invisible man to being highly visible on the front, and suddenly he looked sort of like winner-elect. But it was the first time too that I thought Theo Gegenhardt could do something. I knew that they'd been looking after him in the finale of most stages, but to be honest, he wasn't really on anybody's radar until he outlived all of the big names that fell away on that stage. As he crossed the line, picked up a first ever Grand Tour win, the new GC came up and Theo Gegenhardt had jumped 7 places, now to within inside 3 minutes of the leader, I thought, hang on a minute. If they actually ride for him and he's as good on the mountains to come as he is on this, surely it's game on. Ineos Grenadiers had the strongest team by a country mile. And I just wondered if they believed in it, because if they did, wow.
Piancavallo was a huge day for me to win. To win, you know, it's my first ever World Tour victory. Then to do it at a Grand Tour, then to do it, you know, at somewhere as special as the Giro and on such a beautiful climb and you know, such a full gas climb was really cool. So the third week was obviously critical, but I think there was a lot of major stepping stones on the way, and especially for us as a team, you know, that was the main thing looking back, is how we rode together, but still everyone having the ability to chase individual success, and the way that we just kept that momentum going was incredible, really. The day after that win, Piancavallo was a rest day, and Tezzato came into the room that evening, and we chatted a little bit, and you know, and recapped the previous day, and I wanted to say to him that I didn't want us to change our style of racing because I'd been enjoying it so much and seeing the guys. You know, you have to imagine that I'm sat there saving my energy in the bubble in these starts, and my, by this point, 5 teammates are accelerating like crazy, 100 meters in front of me, trying to get in the brakes, and I'm almost sat there in a movie theater just watching, and you know, taking it all in, and watching them really try very, very hard to get into the brakes. And we were all having such a great time. I just really didn't think that there was any need to change. And ironically, he actually said it before I was able to, that he thought we should keep racing in the same way. And what did I think? And I, you know, I wholeheartedly agreed. So the only stage where we, you know, we decided we weren't going to go for the break was the Sestriere day. We actually still said that if we have someone there, it would be good, because, you know, we'll eventually catch them at some point in the stage, and they can arrive fresher and deeper into the final. But at the same time, we were happy to miss the break that day and impose ourselves from behind. And I have to say that the guys really stepped up to the plate in that final more than any other. And yeah, one by one, they found that extra 20 watts when they hit the front, and we did some serious damage to some pretty tired legs, I would say.
You are listening to Kilometre Zero by The Cycling Podcast, powered by Zwift. the fitness app that turns indoor riding into a game. Explore endless roads, race riders from all over the world, and boost your fitness with monthly training plans and structured workouts. Join the world's training playground, where fun is fast. Go to Zwift.com and start your free trial.
I'm Mitch Docker, pro cyclist for EF Education First, pro cycling team. I personally loved going back to Richmond. That was one of my favourite world championships, and obviously I can't get back to Richmond unless I fly across to the US, but to ride around the course, it felt so surreal. It was crazy going up those cobbles, around those roads. It really did feel like I was back there. London, going up Box Hill, it's crazy because I'm thinking, is this as hard as Box Hill? It's a great feeling. And, you know, the being in their virtual world as well, I think one day when I had a really hard effort, I chose Alpe d'Huez and all I had to do was keep going to the next corner, tick off that corner, tick off that corner, tick off that corner. Next thing I knew, I'd done 40 minutes of bloody hard work and I was at the top of Alpe d'Huez. And that was another great element. It was like, I've ticked off a hard effort, I've fought up this mountain, and I had a really good focus to just get to each corner. It was great. I got inside the world and I completely forgot about what I was doing. My legs didn't, but mentally I was able to get through it.
Richard Moore. My key moment from the Giro was Rohan Dennis. What he did on stage 20 to Sestriere was perhaps even more impressive, but his ride 2 days earlier up the Stelvio was astonishing, and it blew the race apart. Ineos had been working when he took over, with about 47 kilometres of the stage remaining, and about 10 kilometres to the top of the Stelvio. The pink jersey had gone by now, but more or less as soon as Dennis started riding, Fuglsang and Nibali slipped out the back. Then, less than a kilometre further on, Kelderman, the virtual pink jersey, began to falter. This was all down to Dennis. He led all the way up, winning the Cima Coppi, then down the descent, through the valley, and until the lower slopes of the climb to Laghi di Cancano. For Gegenhart, it must have felt like riding behind a motorbike. Without Dennis, it would have been Gegenhart versus two Sunwebs and advantage Sunweb. With him, it was two for Ineos versus one for Sunweb. Advantage Gegenhart.
Yeah, I mean, I just was just wanted to the day to go as well as it could, really. I never envisaged that it would transpire as it did, I have to say. But I knew that it was the first back-to-back mountain stage of the Giro, which was surprising that we'd got that far in, really, being able to say that. And I also knew that, you know, Stelvio is completely foreign to anything else we'd done. It's our first time at high altitudes, and you don't really get much higher than the Stelvio. So I knew there'd be something unexpected. I definitely didn't know that it would be kind of myself and Rowan that were the unexpected parties, as it were. But yeah, what a stage it turned out to be. The Madonna de Campillo climb up from is actually my auntie's village that is at the base of that climb, Pinzolo. So it was quite special for me, that stage. We stayed in her village that night, and yeah, I think we expected more that stage, but we got to the final climb and just saw that it was a little bit headwind, I think, and Sunweb didn't have the team depth that they'd showed on Piancavallo. That was probably the big thing we saw, and there was a few attacks, and you know, I kind of tried to suss out a little bit what was going on, listening, you know, to the guys around me and watching how people rode. But like I said kind of just now, I was pretty aware that Stelvio was a whole nother ball game and just such a different undertaking. I was very, very sure that there would be some kind of surprise that day, and that someone, you know, from that top five or six would really fall away, just from the nature of the stage, how hard it was, and yeah, like I've kind of said a few times, how different riding the last five, six, seven Ks of an hour-long climb at over 2,000 metres is, and you know, close to 3,000.
Yeah, actually, the night before, I was, like, struggling to sleep because I was so excited for that day, actually.
Jai Hindley, Team Sunweb.
The days leading up to that, I was like feeling pretty good. And then that morning, you know, I don't know. Sundays as a rider, you just have these days where you're like, it is my day. Simple as that. You're just on the start line and you're buzzing, you know, you're just super nervous, but at the same time, you just like want to get into it. And yeah, we had like a super ambitious plan that day of like trying to just blow the race to pieces, because we knew, yeah, you'd have to do it on Stelvio if you really wanted to make a difference.
Luke Roberts, sports director, Team Sunweb.
Yeah, I mean, we knew from our side what we needed to do. Obviously, our Mida had been riding quite strong. We needed to try to break him or try to gap him on those, you know, those steeper sections of the Stelvio to give us a chance to win the overall. Of course, it's not only him we had to watch. We knew there was other competitors there that would also be throwing everything at the Stelvio to try to reshuffle the GC. And we'd spoke about a lot of different scenarios and prepared ourselves quite well for it. And we knew there if someone was going midway up the Stelvio looking strong, that we basically just needed to be there, because it would change the race altogether. I mean, we could see that directly after the Piancavallo stage there. Who had settled into the race, who was climbing well. You know, obviously we've seen there directly that Jai and Wilco were among the best climbers, and that Teo would be a really tough nut to crack there. He was sat with us when Jai was pacing on Piancavallo, yeah, and was able to win the stage there. You know, he made it look relatively easy. So we knew he would be a force to be reckoned with, and of course a strong team backing him. So yeah, that was we'd already spoken for days leading up to after Piancavallo and leading up to the Stelvio, that would not only need to look at our Mida, but also Teo would be play a big role in the outcome of the race.
It's Dennis, it's Gagan Hart. Look at this now. Kelderman starts to lose the wheel. It's all change, and Sunweb might be shooting themselves in the foot. Well, we were expecting a big show. We are getting it. Remember, there's an encore to come too. The climb to Lagidi Kankanal. Here we go, and it's happening again. The second time that we've seen Kelderman in slight difficulty, but I think it's about to get more grave, more serious. For now, Hindley follows, and Wilco Kelderman, so close to the pink jersey, could now be in trouble himself. We couldn't get any more drama in the GC battle today. 2 minutes, 41 seconds between Wilco Kelderman and Jai Hindley. 2 minutes, 42 seconds for your notes as this develops later on today. And I'm looking at you, Ryan Carroll Vorderman-Smith, to do the calculation later on, because this gap's now opening up. Kelderman will have to try and recover somehow. We're above 2,000 metres here, and as Brian just alluded to, that can do funny things to your body. Wilco Kelderman was the eternal province and the eternal promise of Dutch cycling.
Yeah, it was, strangely enough, we knew immediately. The first thing we heard on the radio was that he was 1 meter behind, which there's not many times in cycling that you get information kind of that specific and immediate. And it just snowballed from there, really. It went to, I think we then heard 4 or 5 meters, and then it was, you know, a few seconds, 10 seconds. It stayed at 10 seconds for a long time, as far as we knew. And then it was that last 3 or 4 Ks when it really, really went out. And that was interesting, because we were actually, you know, slowing down a little bit, and the gap was still really going out. So that was probably the most interesting point of the climb. That was kind of when Rowan and I spoke a little bit, and I kind of said, you know, we're getting to 30 seconds here. Let's kind of play the long game now and get our jackets, put them on, and then we can, you know, get over the top and make sure we're warm and ready. And then we've got, you know, basically after the descent, we've got 40 minutes to change this race, essentially.
Oh dear, oh no! And that nearly ended in tears for Jai Hindley, who's been struggling for the last few 100 metres this rain jacket on. His problem here is that he's got to hold the wheel. Kelderman's managed it. Come on, John. What an absolute disaster this is. And this is where the cold's going to come into it on the descent as well. Remember, bike handling could be affected, all sorts happening here. And it's not as if he can stop. Learning to get dressed all over again. Come on. The world is willing him on here. Whoever you're supporting, whoever you're watching, we want to see a fight. That's what we want. Jai Hindley can get dressed. That was a sigh of relief there.
I would say more embarrassment than panic. Yeah, that was pretty grim. And apologies, everyone that had to watch that. It was like a whole heap of things. But yeah, it was also real just rookie shit, you know. and the last couple K that I put like my long finger gloves on. And then I had the jacket of the white jersey, the long sleeve white jersey jacket. So it was like a Castelli one. Before the stage, I'd also shoved like four gels in the left pocket. So the left side was like really weighed down. And also, yeah, it was super windy. First, I just couldn't get my arms in the sleeves. And then, oh, man. Then, like, I was trying to do the zip up, but I couldn't because of the long-fingered gloves. And it was just like, it was just epic, you know. And I'm just thinking, like, shit, I did not need this, like, you know, 2,500 meters is hard enough just like riding your bike, let alone trying to do your jacket up, going no hands. And yeah, if I'd stopped, then for sure I wouldn't have seen Rowan and Tao again. So it wasn't actually that cold. I mean, there was snow and stuff, and it was obviously like pretty fresh, but because, yeah, we were just going full noise the whole way up, and the body was just, it was just on fire, you know, like you're just cooking. And we hit the descent, and yeah, I was also in the wheel in the descent, so it wasn't too bad with the jacket flapping about, you know, but yeah, it wasn't ideal. Also didn't look great, and yeah, anyway.
Yeah, that was one scenario. We did see a likely scenario or a likely possibility, one we'd spoken about, one we knew how we would react. So yeah, in that moment there isn't, it was no hesitation. It was all, decision was already thought about up front, based on logic, based on calculations, and yeah. So it was, you know, obviously the emotions can affect it in that moment, but yeah, it was, we basically just stuck to the plan we had, didn't doubt it, and just continued with it. I mean, Wilco was still in with an opportunity. I was still, you know, if at the moment he could not follow anymore. You know, to push it over the limit, then he can't ride any faster on the Stelberg. We're almost at, you know, we're over 2,500 meters at that point. To push it over the limit can see a complete explosion. So he had to resort back to pacing at a level that he could do. Yeah, and then basically just the seven kilometer valley afterwards, where could have been some help. There was also riders coming from behind with Fuglsang, Bill Bauer. So many factors to take into account there as well. But all things that we had thought about, could see unfolding, and yeah, it makes the decisions much easier than on the spot. Yeah, never doubted it. Also didn't, you know, looking back on it, would do the same again. Like I said, it was all based on calculation. I can understand it's also, you know, really tough for Wilco in that situation, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, what Rowan Dennis has done there for Tao, you know, we've seen the huge impact he had on the overall classification, and then we still had the stage on Saturday to come, and you know, basically it was Saturday again, part two of the Rowan Dennis show, which would have, yeah, would have basically ended the race or our overall chances on Saturday evening. So, yeah, I mean, we'd made that decision based on calculations, based on what we could see coming in the following stages, or with Saturday stage still to come. And, yeah, basically it left us still with a chance to win the overall there, still going to the final time trial.
Yeah, I didn't know it was happening. I didn't turn around and I didn't hear like Wilco's dropping. I heard Wilco on the radio say he couldn't hold the wheel. And yeah, I was thinking, oh shit, like, you know. But then they made the call pretty much straight away, like, try just stay on the wheel of Tao. I knew like how good I was feeling that day. Like I knew I was really just gonna be up for trying to get the win that day. I mean, if the team made that call, then it would have been their call and I would have waited. But, I mean, it wasn't easy. It also wouldn't have been easy in the car. And also after that stage, you know, everyone, we were just getting, like, eaten alive by some people. And it's like, I mean, we did end up winning the stage and going into Ping. but we're still just getting like shredded by the media. I don't know. I guess in a situation like that, doesn't matter what you do, you're always going to make someone angry or whatever.
Rowan's a great bloke. We had a really, really good time together in Tirreno, in a few times, you know, training together between the races and then again in the Giro. I enjoyed every single moment with him, I have to say. And that day, you know, I was surprised, to be honest. I wasn't expecting him. I knew he was really focused on the stage. He'd said as much, and I could tell there was something. You could see that he was really starting to get a sniff that, you know, something bigger as transpired was possible. But of course, I didn't expect him to go as far as he did and to do such an incredible job as he did. And then again on Sestriere, you know, he in some ways in Sestriere was maybe even more impressive. I know he didn't take the Cima copy. He didn't, you know, spend quite as long on the front, but nearly. But the manner in which he exploded the race on Sestriere was quite different. It was a lot more explosive and really, really aggressive. And yeah, I mean, in hindsight, I think Rowan changed the race, and I was the lucky and willing passenger, kind of hitched on the back, who benefited from it. So yeah, huge thank you to him.
François Tomaso, my key moment from the Giro was definitely the Stelvio stage, but not for the obvious reasons, not for the beauty of the scenery, not for you know, the action-packed day or anything. It was just that moment, a couple of moments during the Stelvio climb proper and during the final climb, when I definitely had the impression that if Jai Hindley had attacked Teo Gegenhardt, he would have won the stage by, you know, solo, by a margin that might have been enough to win the overall. I mean, there was team tactics involved that day, and you could say everything was fine. Hindley won the stage, Kelderman took the pink jersey, and you know, and everything was achieved on that day. But what if Jai Hindley had attacked? I'm sure he had the means to do it. I'm sure he had the means to take a couple of seconds, maybe 20, maybe 25, maybe 35, maybe what, just what was required to be a match to Theo Gegenhardt on the final TT. And for me, that lost opportunity was the defining moment and the key moment of the Giro.
I don't know. I think it's hard to say. I think if I was going to put time into him, then I would have had to have gone hard from the bottom, because I know that climb pretty well. And I know it's not super hard gradient towards the top, you know, where the switchbacks are. Could I put time into him? I don't know. I mean, it would have been nice to give it a try, but yeah, at the same time that day, you know, I think because I was on Teo's wheel, yeah, he ended up riding it slower than what we could have gone, and therefore the gap back to Wilco wasn't as big, and then Wilco ended up going into pink. On one hand, it would have been nice, but then on the other hand, yeah, it was also nice to see Wilco going to pink.
I mean, I guess the one thing is that when someone's ridden in support of someone like he had on Piancavallo, you see, you know, very clearly, he went as hard as he could for the steepest part of that climb when they dropped Joao. So I, you know, I'd kind of seen that. Of course, a week later, it's completely different when you get to Sestriere and when he's riding for himself. Yeah, I mean, it's been very clear for years that he's super talented. Last year in Poland, he was second to Pavel, and you know, he's had loads of other good results in the under 23s as well with the Aussie national team. So it was no surprise to see him up there. Immense respect for him, and I guess, you know, my main thought was, you know, if I can come into the TT, you know, close or around the same time as him, then it's minimum all to play for, but you know, potentially the ball is a bit more in my court, which in the moment, I, you know, that was something that was a goal rather than like a belief that, you know, I'm going to be better in the TT. I would never have let myself believe that, but it was the goal and the desired outcome, really. Kind of tried to continue the approach that we'd given to the GC and also to the race every day, which was as boring as it is to wake up and focus on that day and not get too carried away by what was coming in the future. And Tosso is incredibly important. You know, he's obviously, goes without saying, unbelievably experienced, but I think the big thing for me was his passion and seeing how happy he was when I won on Piancavallo, especially. I got to see him within a minute or so after the finish over the barriers. You know, seeing that was really cool. I think the Giro has another meaning to Italians and I've seen that many times and to be kind of the person that had made someone, you know, so weathered in race experience as Matteo that happy was really special. And equally Ollie Cookson, who was sat driving the car alongside Matteo for the entire 3 weeks, is someone who I've known for quite a long time and has always really, really supported me so much. Yeah, I never really believed until I crossed the line or maybe on the couple corners before in the TT when Matteo started screaming to slow down. That was probably the first moment where I thought, where I kind of thought, oh, we're upski here for something crazy.
Yeah, we went into that final TT on the same time, you know, and TT is like, it's the race of truth. There's no hiding, and strongest guy wins on the day, basically. So maybe it would have been different with a bit of a time buffer, but like I said, I would have had, looking at the TT, then I would have needed like 40 seconds or something before. It's hard to say, but at the end of the day, I was pretty happy with how I raced and how the team raced, actually. And to be on the final steps there at the end was something, yeah, I'll never forget. You know, it was special, really special. And it was also really nice to have Wilco there as well, you know, because I've seen like the work he's put in leading up and, you know, some of the disappointments he's had over the years and setbacks with injuries and stuff like that. So I was really happy to see him there. And I think it was a good race for the team in the end. You know, it's always super nice to get the win, but yeah, like I said, I didn't expect to be on the podium. So for me to be there was still mind blowing.
I really felt great. We had a nice dinner, all the riders the night before. Again, like I feel like a stuck record, but we were joking around, laughing. Rowan was ripping into me about something, you know, taking the piss. I can't remember what. But we were relaxed and we were happy and we'd won that day. We did a champagne toast. It was mega. It's my fourth victory ever that day. So of course I was happy. And the morning of the race, I rode the course, got on my bike, felt pretty good. That obviously helps. Got back to the room, had some rice and eggs, and I had about an hour and a half then alone in the room when it was the only time I felt a bit nervous. I just turned my phones off and put some music on. My brother had made me a playlist, which, you know, was really nice, and I just relaxed. And then I was with my soigneur, Piero, who I've spent a lot of my career with. He kept me super calm on the drive to the race. We just chatted like we always do. And then it was kind of into the routine that I've been practicing since I started cycling, really, and all the familiar things and the things that you do over and over. And, you know, you're practicing when you don't even know you're practicing. And I've always felt lucky because the track used to make me incredibly nervous. The team suit at the Junior World Championships was when I had knots in my stomach in Glasgow, because I knew that I could let those four guys down just, you know, by starting us half a second too late and missing the wheel. And road racing is, for me, is not nerve-wracking in comparison. I don't know why, but that's all I can say. I've always said that, you know, if you have the best legs, then it shows, and if you don't, then the next best thing is to ride for the guy with the best legs. And I've had a lot of fun doing that over the last few years since I turned pro, and especially I think Egan's winning California and Colombia, Geraint's winning Dauphiné, and Pavel's winning in Poland were incredibly fulfilling and enjoyable. I think it's one of the best things about cycling is that, you know, a guy can be a leader in one race and the next race he's helping and the next race he's a leader again. And And I would anticipate that it will be no different for myself. Of course, it's gonna be a little bit different. I'd anticipate the future. But at the same time, I can only control myself, and I think I can only stay true to what I've always done and always believed, which is to wake up every day excited to get out on my bike. I can't say that more. Excited to train. And aware of the privilege, really, to not only be a professional cyclist, but to ride for this team in particular. I think if I can, keep that perspective on the sport and on everything, then, it's not easy to arrive in your best shape, actually. I spoke to a friend, Brent Brookwalter, who sadly had to leave the race with a fractured vertebrae, and I said to him in the end, mate, I'm going to, this was after about 10 days or 8 days maybe, he'd just got home, and I said to him, I'm going to enjoy this race no matter what, because I know I'm going really well, and I know how hard it is to go really well, and I've tried many times to go really well and not got there. So I think, it's not easy in cycling to be at your best, but that's what we're always aiming for in the end.
You've been listening to an episode of Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast, supported by Zwift. Thanks very much indeed to Zwift for supporting our Kilometre Zero series at the Grandest Tour and also at the Tour de France this year. We are very grateful indeed. This episode was produced by Will Jones.